Thank you very much, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for the invitation to make this presentation today. I'm going to be speaking really a little bit about some of the determinants that affect our ability to sustain attention and maintain our alertness and performance during the daytime. One of them is, of course, how many consecutive hours that we've been awake. If you all were sitting here and had been awake for 48 or 60 or 72 hours, it would be much more difficult for you to attend to the discussion this morning, and your performance would also be impaired. It would be more difficult for you to add numbers. You'd make more mistakes, and notwithstanding the 1964. anecdote that was relayed this morning from Randy Gardner. Subsequent studies indicate that even if you haven't been awake for 11 consecutive days, your intellectual functioning deteriorates. In addition, nightly sleep duration, getting 3, 4, or 5 hours of sleep at night instead of 7 to 8 hours of sleep at night, will also result in a deterioration in alertness and performance. And our studies indicate that your ability to learn over, if you're kept on a schedule in which your sleep is consistently disrupted in the kind of environment that Peter just described, that the ability to get better on something like an addition task, which even when we bring MIT students into the laboratory, if we have them doing sums for a month, they get better and better and quicker and can do more sums in the same interval, unless we chronically deprive them of sleep, in which case that does not occur. biological time of day, of course, as Peter has mentioned, has a profound impact on alertness and performance. And for example, the ability, if we give students passages from the SAT test and simply ask them to recall the information on the task, not even to do any logical reasoning from the paragraph of information that they read, they get just a little over half the number correct at an adverse circadian phase as they do at an appropriate circadian phase. And sleep inertia is the phenomenon where our brain doesn't go from 0 to 60 in 7 seconds when we awaken. It takes some time for us to make that transition, and people are profoundly, in fact, their ability to add numbers is 5 standard deviations below the mean of those same individuals in the first few minutes after awakening. Now, the Institute of Medicine just recently did a meta-analysis and came to the conclusion that 50 to 70 million Americans suffer from some type of chronic sleep disorder. And you've already heard a beautiful presentation outlining some of the individual cases of such disorders. And they include, of course, other illnesses like circadian rhythm sleep disorders and restless leg syndrome and others. The symptoms of sleep disorders, and as you can see here, this looks like one of Dr. Dykin's patients here, but it's actually our vice president. Although he says that he was not asleep, that he was looking at his notes when Chinese President Yin Hu was making his first Oval Office visit earlier this year. In April. But the symptoms of sleep disorders are excessive daytime sleepiness, difficulty initiating or maintaining sleep, early morning awakening, or these abnormal movement sensations, etc. during sleep. What I'm going to talk about are situations in which we remain awake for what I would consider extraordinary periods. For example, hospital interns are scheduled to stay awake twice a week to work 30-hour shifts twice a week. This is in the era of the reformed regulations. The new regulations, which essentially sanction what was being done before, rather than make any real change, but the new regulations, as promulgated by the Accreditation Council of Graduate Medical Education, allow interns to work 30-hour shifts twice a week. And we did a randomized study in which we assigned interns working in the intensive care unit at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. And these interns, 2,000 of them apply every year, and we select 55 to be in the class. So it's a highly competitive a class of interns, and there are another 15 selected for a more general internship. And we studied those highly capable individuals working in the intensive care unit on the traditional schedule, which is theoretically required to train a doctor to be a physician in the United States, in which they work these 30-hour shifts twice a week, and then on an intervention schedule in which they work no more than 16 consecutive hours, in which they're scheduled to work no more than 16 consecutive hours. And when we compared the two schedules, and incidentally, the attending physicians said that the care of the patients would be very severely adversely affected if the same intern who admitted the patient in the morning to the intensive care unit was not with them all night, that individual knew those patients so much better that their care would be far better. But we found that they made actually 36% more serious medical errors when working that shift and 464% more serious diagnostic mistakes on the patients that they knew better. And Dr. Siegel, that's just one night without sleep. That's not 11 consecutive days. And they claim to be very highly motivated to care for these patients. 50% of these patients die before they are discharged from the units, and they're doing their best to try to take care of them while they're there. In fact, when we surveyed interns nationwide, 2,700 interns who we followed for 1,400 person years, we found that one out of five of the interns admitted to making a fatigue-related mistake that injured a patient, and that was increased 700% when they were scheduled to work these marathon 24-hour shifts. One out of 20 interns admitted to a fatigue-related mistake that resulted in a death of a patient. And there are 100,000 interns and residents in the United States. So when one out of five of them are injuring patients and one out of 20 are making mistakes that result in death of a patient, we're talking about tens of thousands of injuries and thousands of deaths annually associated with this, with these fatigue-related mistakes. But they're not just injuring the patients. They're also injuring themselves. There is a 73% increased risk at the same time of day during a daytime procedure if they're working with sharp instruments having been awake all night as opposed to working with those same sharp instruments during the first 12 hours of their workday. And driving home from their extended duration shifts, they have 168% greater risk of a motor vehicle crash when they're driving home from shifts of 24 hours or longer, and a 468% increased risk of a near miss. We know that performance as measured by reaction time is severely degraded when you're awake for 24 consecutive hours. In fact, when we look here at the median reaction time, you see that it goes from about a quarter of a second to almost a second, or a little over a second. So it's almost if a child runs in front of your car, even if you do manage to stay awake, it's going to take three times longer for you to put your foot on the brake. So summarizing, I would contend that these data indicate that there is a deterioration in neurobehavioral performance associated with even a single day of sleep deprivation. And I would submit that these young physicians who are required as a condition of their licensure to run this sort of a marathon, it's like a it would be like a survivor episode, except there is no safety net under either the patients or the young physicians in training who are trying to care for them. And this is putting the patients, their physicians in training, and the families and fellow motorists who are on the road at risk. In fact, a recent graduate of the Harvard Medical School, while he was doing his residency, fell asleep at the wheel and killed two people. An intern in her first 3 weeks of a rotation at Rush Presbyterian Medical Center in Chicago fell asleep at the wheel and rear-ended a car, and the victim in that particular crash has been declared incompetent by the courts because of a severe neurological injury that resulted, and she had been a volleyball star in college and was getting her master's degree at the time of the injury. And the question that I wonder in this circumstance, in the medical profession, because we certainly can't begin to try to tell people in other professions how to make improvements if we don't start at home within the medical profession. Who should be responsible for the next sleep-related error or accident that one of these interns or residents commit? Should it be, as Rush Presbyterian Medical Center has contended successfully and argued up to the Illinois Supreme Court, that it is the responsibility of that intern that she should be legally and financially responsible for caring for that brain-damaged person for the rest of her life, because the institution that is scheduling the people to do this work will not stand behind the people when they are disabled and when they hurt people. On the other hand, it's easy to say, for example, that a truck driver who's staying awake for 30 or 40 hours in order to earn extra money, it's easy to say, well, they should go to jail. And there's a trucker in Florida who is serving a 15-year prison term for having been awake for this same duration of time and falling asleep and killing three tourists from England who were visiting Florida when he had that accident. So it's somewhat easy to make that mistake. Physicians, if you ask, when I've gone and spoken to physicians and asked whether the interns and residents should go to jail in that circumstance, usually the answer is no. And I think that's because, in comparison to the trucker, while everyone's willing to send the trucker to jail, somehow it's felt that the physicians are doing the work of God, I guess, and therefore they should be exempted from responsibility for what happens when they get behind the wheel of a car. But we all have to realize that when you get behind the wheel of a car, you are taking a whatever caused you to be impaired, whether it's because your child was up all night and you didn't sleep, or if it is because you took a drug that has that caused. There's a person who was convicted of vehicular homicide in Massachusetts who was given a drug by their physician, which made them sleepy. They had fallen asleep at the wheel before. One time he fell asleep at the wheel and killed another driver, and he was convicted of vehicular homicide on the grounds that the judge said, you knew that this had happened before. These interns and residents, they're falling asleep at the wheel every day or several times a week or a month when they're driving home from these shifts, so they certainly realize that they're impaired. And therefore, State Senator Richard Moore from Massachusetts came to us and said, when he saw some of the results of the work in the newspaper, and said we should really do something to put into law some regulations in Massachusetts that would outline the responsibility of individuals and the hazards associated with sleep deprivation. And in response to that, at the time I was president of the Sleep Research Society, we set up a task force on sleep and public policy, in which I invited Dr. Dinges, who was president of the World Federation of Sleep Research Societies, Dr. Epstein, who was at the time president of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, Dr. Walsh, who was president of the National Sleep Foundation, and Dr. Landrigan, who was a director of sleep and patient safety at the Brigham, to work on developing some model legislation for Massachusetts. And after 2.5 years, getting the various boards of the organizations to agree on proposed language, the Sleep Research Society and the National Sleep Foundation have endorsed this legislation. We could not get the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, which is, of course, composed of practicing physicians, to endorse this language. They agreed that anyone who drives a car for 24 hours should go to jail if they hurt someone, but they said doctors are different. The recommendations of the endorsed language, which is currently pending in Massachusetts, is that weekly work hours should be limited to 60, that consecutive work hours optimally, which would apply to all in high intensity settings like ICUs and emergency rooms, should not be more than 10 consecutive hours, with a maximum in any setting of 18 consecutive hours. And one of the most interesting provisions of this pending legislation is that for all physicians, whether they're in training or not, that if the physician has been awake for more than 22 of the previous 24 hours, it would require notification of the patient. Now, drowsy driving in the United States is a problem of enormous significance. 80,000 people a day, that's about once every second, fall asleep at the wheel in the United States. Half of them drift into another lane across the median strip. And the federal highway, the federal government, first they said it's not a problem, and then when more and more evidence was presented to them and all the statistics of people running off of the road, they finally realized that it's a huge problem. And so they have now mandated that any federal highway built anywhere in the United States has to have a rumble strip. Now, a rumble strip is not a perfect solution to the problem, but a rumble strip at least awakens some of the people who happen to drift in that direction. Now, that, even since the rumble strips, there have been crashes associated with breaks in the rumble strip where the rest area is and people fall asleep in an unfortunate location. And now one of the biggest problems is that people are relying on the rumble strips. It's an unforeseen consequence of the construction of these rumble strips. So now they're saying, well, you know, I really don't need to sleep because the rumble strip will awaken me. And so one of the biggest areas of crashes are cars in the rumble strip. So the next legislation that Senator Moore is putting into, because we just had a state trooper 4 o'clock in the morning after working a double shifts for a number of consecutive days in the row, father of seven, who drifted off into the rumble strip, and unfortunately there was a truck that was in the rumble strip lane and he was killed instantly. That was this past year. So now, and you know, it was interesting in the papers, the hue and cry was not that he had drifted off of the lane and gone into the rumble strip. The hue and cry was, why was this truck in the rumble strip? And it turns out that the law in Massachusetts, which was passed many, many years ago, was that you have 24 hours to clear a vehicle after, if it is disabled and in the breakdown lane. Because that was a time when the breakdown lane was for disabled vehicles. The breakdown lane is currently a wake-up strip. So if your car breaks down, you should never stay in your vehicle in the breakdown lane. In fact, Senator Moore is passing legislation, it's proposed legislation that would require that you go off of the wake-up strip and into the area immediately adjacent to that with your vehicle, because the rumble strip is so important, and it's become, with 80,000 people a day and 40,000 people a day drifting either into the rumble strip or another lane, it's become an essential component of our highways. There's a drowsy driving crash every 2 minutes. In fact, one out of every 5 crashes in the United States and one out of every 5 serious injuries, which means 8,000 deaths a year, are associated with drowsy driving. In fact, fatigue is the most common cause of fatal-to-the-driver truck crashes. One-third of all fatal-to-the-driver truck crashes is due to fatigue. It equals drug and alcohol-related crashes combined for fatal-to-the-driver truck crashes. And yet we spend $300 million a year on alcohol-related crash education prevention, and we spend about $200,000 to $300,000 a year on drowsy driving education. It's a bit of an imbalance. And however, drivers in a number of states and in Britain have been convicted of vehicular homicide for driving while impaired by sleepiness. New Jersey has passed a law which we didn't find to be a good model, because it indicated that if you'd slept for 5 minutes in the previous 24 hours, you would not be responsible. Or if you were sleepy because of a medical condition like sleep apnea, you would not be responsible. And that's why we came up with this other legislation, which in Massachusetts would establish the crime of falling asleep or being impaired by drowsiness or sleep deprivation while driving. It adds falling asleep while operating a motor vehicle or being impaired by drowsiness, of which the person was aware or could reasonably be expected to be aware, to the list of criminal offenses that constitute reckless driving. And it would establish that if you've been awake for 22 of the previous 24 hours, that would be a presumption of impairment. Senator Moore kept saying, you know, if you had something like a breathalyzer, that would really help us. In fact, right now, they reconstruct the prior work history, you know, from your cell phone records and your employment records and your ATM usage, and from your going into credit card usage and fast lane on various highways that captures. It's often possible to reconstruct your sleep, and witness statements, of course. It's often possible to reconstruct your sleep-wake schedule. And that's the way this law is based. But if Paul Shaw, who is going to be the next speaker, is successful in developing an assay for testing homeostatic sleep pressure, that would even be much more ideal. these crashes happen, as I mentioned before, every hour. This happens to be one that is particularly egregious, in which a woman and her infant son were killed in a crash, and her sister-in-law and her 18-month-old daughter were severely injured. And at first nothing happened, and then a year and a half later, after the family did some investigation, they found that the truck driver had seen a doctor who told him he needed to be evaluated for sleep apnea. And then in order to get his commercial driving license without getting that evaluation, he went to another doctor. And so he now faces charges of involuntary manslaughter. There is a... this is an example of another recent injury in which... a young man who had been awake all night playing video games fell asleep at the wheel and killed his grandmother and severely brain injured his brother in a fall asleep crash. In fact, there is an epidemic of drowsy driving crashes in young people. 2/3 of all the drowsy driving crashes happen in people under 30 years of age, and you can see here that it peaks in the late teens and early 20s in terms of the number of drowsy driving crashes. So as the larger drowsy driving bill is winding its way through the various committees in Massachusetts in this civics lesson that we're receiving, we decided to take the initiative to try to get a junior operators bill passed. And as Roger mentioned at the outset, we... On January 3rd, 10 minutes before he walked down the red carpet ending his term as governor, despite the fact that he left 35 other bills unsigned on the docket, we made sure that he was aware that this bill needed to be signed, and Governor Romney did sign a junior operators law that adds... that initiates a drowsy driving educational campaign for all... individuals trying to get a driver's license in Massachusetts and will teach them the hazards of sleep deprivation, and establishes a special commission to study the impact of drowsy driving on highway safety and determine what sort of standards of evidence, and we're very excited to await Paul Shaw's research to find out if he can develop the equivalent of a breathalyzer, and the appropriate sanctions for operating a motor vehicle while sleep deprived. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Jack. As you said, we should take Paul Shaw now to... there are a couple of questions if anybody wants to ask them. Jerry, very quick one.
Yeah, I just want to make it clear, I agree with everything you said. I'm not saying, I wouldn't want Randy Gardner to be my physician or my
Great.
Driver. My interest, and the point I was trying to make with this videotape, is that as sleep deprivation progresses, he was capable of playing basketball, he was capable of playing chess, but his performance undoubtedly degraded. My interest is in...
Was he capable of driving?
Yes, certainly, because he was capable of,
but not safely,
playing basketball. Well, not for long periods of time, and I mean I'm with you on
right.
restricting physician hours and truckers hours. I don't think kids should go to school sleepy because they can't learn well. The issue here is there a capability to perform these things for short periods of time that tells you one thing about brain function? Is it a good thing to be sleepy and doing all these things? I couldn't agree more.
Right, and I just wanted to clarify, because
yeah,
I knew that you didn't have that extreme position, but as you know, for many people in the audience, it might have seemed like it
no,
was
I mean, this is why I showed the video
right.
of the car crash. I think your work, I think Dave Dinges' work, showing that even a little bit of sleep deprivation is incredibly cumulative. You never adjust to even an hour less sleep a night. And so there's no disagreement here.
Okay, great.
Given how pervasive and apparently severe even these kinds, any of these deprivation effects might be, do you understand, since I certainly don't, why it's therefore so important to be used as an interrogation technique by our government that it required an act of Congress to authorize it?
That's a very That's a very interesting question. I just recently testified in court in Maryland when related to a case. There were actually the Prince George's County Police Department there was using sleep deprivation as a means of extracting confessions from prisoners, and they actually had two individuals who confessed to murders that they did not commit, who were subsequently exonerated when the real killer was found in one case, and when DNA evidence made it clear that the husband did not commit the crime in the other. And yet those police were being essentially taught in their training programs that sleep deprivation was, as I think one of the officers put it, one of the tools in their toolkit, even though it is clear that it increases the level of suggestibility. There's a confusion, there are hypnagogic hallucinations, there's a confusion between reality and what has actually happened and under the stressful circumstance of that kind of an interrogation. So you don't really get reliable information under that circumstance, but you do get responses. And so I guess that's maybe what if you want a confession and you don't care about whether the person did it or not, that would be a good way to proceed.
This is for either Chuck or Jerry. I'm wondering if either of you know of any published studies that show that after 30 hours or more of sleep deprivation, there are higher cognitive functions that are unimpaired, even for periods as short as 2 or 3 minutes.
You know, we tried to find, one of the reasons we started that memory testing experiment was because, and with the SAT exam paragraphs, was because a number of years Simon Folkhard had reported that, from England, that although many performance parameters followed what the daily cycle of body temperature, which is at its nadir in the nighttime, that performance on that particular type of memory recall test was actually best when all the other measures were worst. But he had not really measured across the full 24 hours. And when we did the tests in the environment where we're shielded from periodic changes in the outside world, we're not just working in the 9-to-5 sort of schedule, we found that it was profoundly adversely affected at exactly the same phase when they were awake for 24 hours and so on. So we have actually explicitly tried to find any test that would be better in association with sleep deprivation and have been unable to do so.
Move on to...
Thank you.
Thanks.